This is The Good Die Young, the podcast where we deep dive into the greatest television you barely saw. I'm your host, Les Weiler. Join me as I take you through what made these shows too pretty to live. This is The Good Die Young. Season 1, The Middleman. Hey, what's up, man?
Hey, Les, what's going on?
Not a whole lot.
Awesome.
Sorry, I was just looking up one last actor on this.
I was looking through your notes myself here, and well, my God, they are thorough.
Yeah.
Don't take this the wrong way, but I'm so glad I'm not doing a time travel show with you.
Yeah, so like basically, before I do these, I watch through the episode, and I pause it and write down every location. Like, so I know I annotate like a location change, any memorable quote, who said it, anybody that jumps out of like, who's that actor, I'll put a star by it of like, find out who this character. So I note down like every major character, location, catchphrase, and then like keep a running. The first couple times I did that, it didn't occur to me that that would not actually add up to a synopsis. Like it just sounds like a disjointed bunch of craziness. Great Esquivel's ghost. We're here once more to do a Good Die Young episode on The Middleman, and I'm here with Nick Ties.
That's me.
Yes, from the Unapologetic Geek Out podcast.
Oh yeah, and I'm super excited to be here. I didn't get the email. What episode are we talking about today? Is it fish zombies? Are we talking about fish zombies, Les?
No, I'm sorry. Oh. It's not fish zombies.
Okay, well, at least, you know, maybe Evil Boy Band. What are we talking about?
No,
Ghostbusters?
No, listen, this time I've got you down for the you're going to love this. It's the Kevin Sorbo episode. Obsolescent Cryogenic Meltdown.
Kevin Sorbo?
Disappointed.
For those of you who don't know, Kevin Sorbo, the myth is that on an episode of Hercules, The Legendary Journey, or whatever it was called, he read stage direction instead of his lines. So instead of yelling a line disappointedly, he yelled disappointed instead. And apparently that wasn't what happened. He was interviewed later and he said that he was actually doing a reference himself. He was doing a reference from A Fish Called Wanda, a 1988 film. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And I looked up the clip. I'm like, oh, he just did a really poor job of imitating that guy. That's what the problem was.
Okay. Okay. Disappointed!
Still, points for a Monty Python movie reference. Fish Called Wanda's great, if you haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I do love that, the idea of him yelling like, acting! Because he's in this episode and he really gets to ham it up. Having followed Kevin Sorbo just as a guy, as a public figure, and knowing that his, you know, personal beliefs and political beliefs differ from mine fairly greatly, I'm always impressed that he seems willing to ham it up and mock himself a little bit. Be goofy for the role.
Yeah, he's really pretty much up for anything, and that's what I do got to give him. I got to admit, though, anytime I see Kevin Sorbo in anything, I'm kind of like,
yeah, it seems like the last couple of things I've noticed him in are like God's Not Dead and stuff, where I'm like, I'm not the target audience for this.
Do you watch Supergirl?
Oh God, that's right. They made me feel bad for him.
Yeah. Okay. But there's a reason he only lasts a couple episodes. I don't know. For me, it's like Hercules is obviously the weakest among those older geek shows, but people still kind of remember it. But like, they all get grandfathered into basically every other cult, like geeky show. Like, every genre show has like, you know, a Lucy Lawless cameo or a Bruce Campbell cameo. And it keeps those people in work, which is cool. But it means that like, oh, that means I get an episode of Kevin Sorbo in my Supergirl. And I'm like, it's not like he's a bad actor, but like there's so many other actors that could have played the role like better.
And he's forever going to be in that pantheon now. Like he's always, yeah, you're right. He's always going to be in that list of like, who can we get for a certain level of sci-fi nerd reference? Oh, we can throw Sorbo in, and a certain portion of nerddom will go, Hercules.
And you know what? It's not his fault. I mean, he's just saying yes to a paycheck. Like, that's totally his prerogative.
And in fairness, he did Andromeda as well. I just didn't watch any of it.
I didn't watch any of it either.
Well, on to this episode, The Obsolescent Cryogenic Meltdown, which is episode 9 of The Middleman's only season. Written by Tracy Stern, directed by Michael Grossman. And it opens in one of my favorite locations, because I'm a sucker for puns, the Batter of the Bulge Pancake House.
Well, in the pantheon of places I'd like to be taken to by a gentleman caller...
You don't find the promise of Luftwaffles and Panzer cakes irresistible?
I love this place, and I hope it's real, but I know that if it is real, that it exists in Austin, and you would know about it. So
I feel like it would. Like, I can't believe... This seems like the kind of thing... I mean, not that Middleman's not full of these, but like if they were doing a Comic-Con thing now for Middleman, if this show were out now, which if this show were on now is a sad drinking game to play, you'll bum yourself out because Twitter would have saved this and the fandom would have been crazy. And at Comic-Con, I would have gotten to, you know, order Luftwaffles and Panzer cakes in like a faux diner they took over. You know that would happen.
With a side of a damn fine cow squirt.
Yes.
And it's funny you mentioned Comic-Con. I was just previously in between recording our previous episode. I was just at a con and I mentioned I was doing a retrospective episode by episode review of Middleman that I was working with you on this. And half the room lit up. I was just like, whoa, this is a bigger response than I thought, because from like a month and a half ago, I was not aware of this show existed, and now I'm getting like applause and praise that I'm just talking about it at a convention center. So it, again, to your point, you are absolutely correct. It is just sad to think that this show was just too early. It was too ahead of its time. Like,
And just by a hair. I mean, just by a year or two, I think, because like the writer's strike ended and they made Middleman. So 2007, 2008 is when this aired. So I went into ATX Fest with the idea to do two different shows. I knew I wanted to do like a deep dive into one of two like just beloved shows of mine that were one season darlings, and Middleman was one of them. But the other one was streaming on Netflix. I won't name what it is and muddle the discussion. But Middleman is not streaming on subscription. It is streaming. It's on iTunes and Amazon, but it's not on Netflix or Hulu as a package. So I had actually decided, like, I'm not going to do Middleman. I don't know anybody else that's really watched it. I mean, I have a handful of friends that have, but even on my like broader geek circle, I don't know a lot of people that have watched it. And I went to the panel from both of the shows that I loved. Both had panels at ATX Fest and both had huge responses. And I expected it from the other show, though it still surprised me, the depth of fan response. But for Middleman, the questions that everybody had about where these characters went and the amount of love, and like hearing an entire room yell "Art Crawl," and then like somebody yelled "Art Crawl" and the whole room yelled it back, was fantastic. And like I got to talk to Javi for a minute, and I talked to Natalie Morales that weekend, and came away from it going, nope, sold. Middleman is the one we're going to do first. Yeah. So that's so cool to hear that there's interest, and it gives me hope that somebody will have to sit through this, in which case I'm sorry I'm rambling.
No, that's fine. I'm sorry you're gonna have to sit through my my horrible puns, because I'm about to make one. I want to get back to the batter of the Bulge Pancake House, because I know I would get kicked out there because I love to order French toast, and I know they'd kick me out because you'd be like, I'm sorry, we don't serve surrender bread here.
You're not welcome in this bunker of maple syrup and mortar fire. So Dubby meets Tyler Ford there, and Tyler immediately hands her two rolls of quarters and covers her and makes her cover her eyes.
Sweet mother of Nolan Bushnell.
I don't know if you know, but Nolan Bushnell started Atari. So she yells an ode to the founder of Atari, because they've got a coin-op stand-up version of Gutwrencher 1, which is a game that they've referenced. Like, she plays Gutwrencher. They do like a Sherlock Holmes thing in the pilot episode about her telltale Gutwrencher calluses on her thumbs that Middleman detects. Mm-hmm. So they've got Gutwrencher 1, which is the only video game denounced by both Tipper Gore and the Dalai Lama, which that's just great. I don't know if people remember Tipper Gore, but she denounced rap music pretty spectacularly. You can Google the really awesome congressional hearings with, like, I think it's like Frank Zappa and Ice-T and Dee Snider from Twisted Sister. It's great. They're really fun. I don't get to say this often. They're really fun congressional hearings.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't go with Jack what's his face from the Grand Theft Auto, like that lawyer. I forget what his name is, but like they go for the even more obscure reference, which I love.
So the coin op, unlike the home version, has four additional levels, but it's banned in 17 countries. So they play through. It takes $18 in quarters, and they win it on this spectacular date, which actually does sound like a rad date.
Look, how adorable is that?
Oh,
that
it's
is,
great.
I mean, I don't know about you, Les, but like I spent a lot of time in like Chuck E. Cheese's and arcades, and I had my own gut-wrencher one. It was the stand-up Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game, in which I would make a friend for a day, and we would have an unspoken bond for finally getting through and beating up Bebop and Rocksteady. Like it's a intimate thing. It really is. I understand why they are totally into each other and totally ready for sex later.
Well, you'll love to know that Nolan Bushnell, besides starting Atari, also started Chuck E. Cheese.
I did not know that, but now that's great. That makes sense. That's such a circle of life thing.
So it is slightly disturbing on the references that what they beat with a Scud missile to win the game is an 86th level blood catamite.
Yeah, and you sent me the notes.
Catamite's not a word you want to Google for etymology.
No. I looked it up and it's a sad, sad word.
Yeah, it's a kept boy for icky purposes. that kill it with a Scud missile, which I don't know that it's the catamite's fault in this case by definition. But either way, they win the game, costs $18, and it's easily the most disturbing reference. I've got to be misspelling this. There's got to be a different word or a different etymology, because the word I looked up was just awful. Anyway, they go back to the illegal sublet and they hook up. Wendy lays her middle watch on the nightstand. We cut to middle headquarters and you realize that there's a camera in the middle watch.
Ida, what the?
Quite the Manx, isn't she?
Story of O! Turn it off!
But yes, but he also, because he's carrying this a head of a some sort of statue head, which I don't know if it ever gets explained, but he's got like the...
It doesn't, it
like,
doesn't.
It's just a statue head that he's... But he covers the statue's eyes. It's just... I love this man. I love him.
Oh, yo, Matt Kiesler is flawless. Flawless in every episode. So he's modest on Dubby's behalf and tries to cover things up, and Ida just like, nope, it's standard operating procedure, this is just how it goes, and don't be such a wuss. And she basically turns it right back on when he leaves the room. So we cut back to the apartment, and Wendy is complaining to Lacey the next morning about her mutant power, that she always knows how her relationships will end. And Lacey goes through the list of all of her exes, and like, you know, her most recent one dumped her, filmed it, put it on my tube or my face in a tube, their YouTube, MySpace, Facebook mashup, and then got a like multi-picture deal out of it. And I love Lacey's like, you even knew that one? Like, I knew it would involve film.
Yeah. So this like ability kind of comes out of nowhere in the story. And I would call it like a cheesy dialogue thing of like mutant power, really. But then I'm like, oh, I use that term a lot. Like, I've literally told people that I have a mutant ability to absorb certain types of alcohol, in which I don't get hungover when I drink whiskey. I actually feel stronger. Like, it fuels me. But then tequila is my kryptonite. Like, so I'm like, oh, I can't call this out because I've done this exact thing.
Yeah, so Ben, Steve, Rodney, and Tommy Tan, all of Dubby's exes, and even though they never really get, other than Ben, they never really get brought up in the series, they're all those names are consistently named of the repeating things in the series, like Tommy Tan's been brought up before.
With a show with this much crazy dialogue and script writing, they are amazingly consistent on what they bring up.
If you'll notice on IMDb, which is always a little iffy for titles sometimes, but almost everybody is listed like as having written their one show, but then they're writers on all the shows, and they'll be down as like story editor or some other term that can mean different things on different shows. But But it definitely, from the writers I've talked to on the show, they all had a hand in it, and you just took point on your episode. But they definitely kept it consistent. They kept the, you know, they would encourage the writers, like, if it was your episode, to throw in as many references as possible. Side note, there are Jolly Fats Weehawken shirts. Dubby comes downstairs wearing a Jolly Fats Weehawken work shirt, and I want one.
Well, I did not even realize that. You know what? I want one too.
Her fake cover business has merch. What the fuck? Like, I love it.
It's the prop team spent a whole goddamn day making one shirt for reference.
Somebody ironed on that one shirt. I just love the idea that, like, your cover business went that far. Like, you know? So, as Dubby's complaining about her mutant power of knowing how relationships will end, the thing she's bothered about is so navel-gazingly, like, self-sabotage. She's sad that she doesn't know how it'll end.
Well, yeah, and, like, even, like, it knows her, calls her out on it, right?
Oh, yeah.
That just sounds to me like a coping mechanism to avoid intimacy.
It's him calling out, like, exactly where this thing is going by the end of the episode, because he's almost winked at the audience, like, you guys know where this is going, right? And it's interesting to me, because I'm realizing throughout this whole series that the main romantic entanglement has almost no real conflict in it. Like, well, not to say there's not conflict, but there's, like, they have problems of, like, not being able to see each other and stuff, but, like, they never really argue. Nothing is ever really, like, they never leave the honeymoon phase in season one. Like, maybe if they hit season two, they would have gotten it, but, like, there's nothing. It's kind of like this mutant ability is generated because we need to create a conflict in a relationship that's basically perfect.
Yeah, and Limerence, like, Middleman calls it out a little bit later when she's complaining to him about it, that like, this is the Twitter patient stage, like, this is the puppy love, this is the honeymoon phase, and that you just need to enjoy it, and, like, she's already antsy and looking for what's going to go wrong or what's going to blow up.
Yeah, and I think he says, like, her mutant power is like, it sounds like something out of one of those hateful independent films.
Yep, this is why I stick to Westerns. Yeah, and I love Lacey.
You gotta stop looking for the emotional ripcord, Dub-Dub, or you're gonna find out that your parachute is really a backpack.
Like, that's a pretty good metaphor. I'm surprised
it really works. And I love that Dubby's like, what does that even mean? Dubby gets back to headquarters, and she's complaining to Middleman. I love that he almost immediately, because he's a good guy, tells her about the surveillance.
Yeah, because he's like, I just need to let you know that, like, when we have a code 86, you just gotta type that in, and, you know, and we won't monitor. It's like, you've been monitoring me? Like, yeah, well, of course we have.
Well, and I love that the code 86, which is what would cut you some privacy, the nearest thing I can find for why that's a reference, it would be Agent 86 from Get Smart, which is the cone of silence.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's the best I can think, is that Code 86 is an oblique cone of silence reference, which would make sense in the context of all the spy show references. This episode is thematically just really heavy on spy show.
Yeah, for all the references, like, this is the episode where a lot of the references go over my head, because they reference 60s spy shows, and, like, it's like the one genre I'm like, I am not very familiar with it. I get the James Bond stuff. But that's a
yeah. But like
it.
The Protectors, like, I didn't watch the Protectors. I had to look up. Like, that's not even like, when I think Robert Vaughn, 60s spy show, I think Man from U.N.C.L.E. But
that sounds like a C-list Defenders team. Like, it's like not the Avengers. The Protectors.
Right. So Ida comes in just as they're discussing the code 86 and says that there's been some jewelry stolen from Klebs Fine Jewelers. And that things have been melted like butter, which is just a 90s or a not 90s, I guess 2000s reference. But Middleman has from basically that point forward, you can tell that there's something, as he puts it, strangely, uncannily familiar to him about the MO of this crime. And so after visiting Klebs Fine Jewelers, where the proprietor is definitely KGB.
Are you sure about that? No. They asked him twice, and they said no both times. I mean,
and in fairness, she may be Spectre, because Rosa Klebb is a Bond villain from To Russia with Love, or From Russia with Love.
You know what? Let's settle this. Like, you know what? I know a Russian guy. Vlad, come over here. Well, yes. Those guys, no, they're definitely not KGB.
Oh, thanks, Vlad.
Yeah, thanks, Vlad. That was really helpful. All right. Sorry about that. I didn't think you'd jump right on the mic.
So, the middleman, by finding something strangely, uncannily familiar, says we got to go back and check the middle lore. So,
middle lore?
They basically just go do, like, the Scooby gang, like the Buffy scene. There's always the go back to the library, like Sam and Dean in the bunker, checking the lore. And Dubby's just bored to tears.
In the immortal words of Bertolt Brecht, hungry man, reach for a book. It is a weapon.
Brecht was a communist.
So as they go through the old villain names, I love it. They've got the Domino, who wanted to knock down all the buildings, and of course, one big nefarious plan.
Check this guy out. A fabulous face. He tried to replace everyone in the White House with evil doubles.
And he succeeded, although no one seemed to notice at the time.
But no one noticed for quite a while.
Yeah.
And that just made me think of our current events, and I'm like, oh, this is... It's funny because it hurts a little.
Dr. Solaris wanted to put a boredom toxin in the water supply, and he mentions that Dubby looks bored. And I think this is actually when she tells him about her mutant power. He gets to say that this is why, love is simple. Either have it or you don't. Anything else is delusion or self-sabotage. Fragments of moon rock! And he comes across the info on the candle.
What's with the space age bachelor pad music?
As soon as he finds out about the candle,
Ida just jumps right into action, actually. Like, he mentions it, like, offhand. It's like, Ida, do this. And then he's kind of, like, looking off, like, what are you... I gave you an order. It's like, sorry, but I had special orders. And she flips, like, this switch. And it's like, hey, what the hell's that door for? Like, well, of many things, this is one thing. It's like this cryo chamber, right?
Yes. Yeah, the middleman's cryo chamber. And I love that one of the first things she does, while that's all defrosting, is start a record player going. On what is an original piece of music. Like, I really thought that they got... There's a guy, Esquivel, who did what is literally Space Age Bachelor Pad music. That's just these crazy... Like, there's no lyrics. They're huge orchestras, and the music is zany and like, lots of just weird scat vocals and stuff. And the music definitely, like, Tree Adams wrote this piece of music that's called Space Age Bachelor Pad, and it's actually on YouTube. I'll try to make sure we have a link. And it's just, it very much echoes that Esquivel style. So I love that it starts up, like, you kind of know what you're getting. Like, there's going to be this in, like, Flint something about to happen. And lo and behold, Kevin Sorbo. Naked as the day he was born.
He ordered me to do this. He told me to unfreeze him if the candle ever reared his ugly head again.
Who?
Wendy Watson, boss, allow me to present, all the way from 1969.
You can call me the middleman.
And I just love, like, oh, so we just had a frozen middleman in the fucking basement.
This whole time.
There wasn't need to know information at all for the current middleman. Okay, fine.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that he never trained anyone. Like, I would love to know who took over from Sorbo.
Who was his sidekick?
Yeah.
Like, that would have been a shit job.
I bet they just froze him, and then, like, Ida had to go find somebody. Which, I really want to see the middleman who got purely trained by Ida.
Out of all this, like, middle lore, I kind of, like, wish we would have heard of, like, some of the other middlemen along the way. Like, I know there's only a limited time for season one, but, like, this is a pretty good idea. That I feel like could have been explored maybe a little bit more, but, you know.
I love how much of their, like, it's not a cut and dry role. How much of their attitude is personal. Like, he's this middleman. The middleman is what we think it is purely because of the current middleman and who he is and who you find out in actually the 2014 table read a little bit more about who recruited him. But for me, like, when you just say, oh, there's been middlemen going back to time immemorial, some reason I don't not care about that history, but I don't desperately want to know about it. You put that pinch point down in 1969, which is the year that Sorbo goes into cryogenic freeze. Now I suddenly want to know everything that happened between 1969 and 2008.
He's like, I just need the timeline.
I want to read that right now. So yeah, he gets thawed, immediately sends Ida out for booze. She comes back with another James Bond reference, fifth of Fleming's Commander Jamaican Rum, and a bottle of High Karate.
I do love that this middleman drinks very heavily. Like, he's so the opposite of our middleman. Like, middleman 69 is basically the negative, the anti-middleman in many ways.
Yes, High Karate, the other thing he sends Ida out for, is a cheap aftershave sold in the U.S. in the 60s. I believe, actually, for the Kickstarter to get the last comics and everything going, they gave away the prop that was made but not used. They have a cologne for him that was just never shown on screen, but there's a scene where Mary Pat Gleason holds it.
My God, that is obscure.
Yeah, but that's one of the things they gave as a stretch goal. Yeah, I think it was a stretch goal. Middleman has given specific instructions. 1969, 69 as we'll call him from now on.
Get it?
And he's also cheeky, so, you know, he just stands there looking creepily at Dubby and constantly making references to, you know, why you dress a girl like that in sack, and I bet she's got stems on her. And it's just, it's every bad madman can't talk to women like that thing possible.
Yeah.
And Sorbo's just so slimy and perfect at it. It's just really, really great and bad at the same time.
I'll admit right now that, like, when Kevin Sorbo first came up, I was disappointed. I was like, oh, really, Kevin Sorbo? Because I don't know, maybe we'll do some fantasy casting later, but I'm like, ah, oh, I could think of like 3-4 other people that would have been perfect for this. But then he starts going, and I'm like, oh, I've never really seen smarmy Sorbo. And I'm like, this isn't too bad. I'm kind of digging this.
Yeah, he does a pretty great job at it. And I'm with you. I'm not the world's biggest Kevin Sorbo fan. I haven't ever minded him, but I haven't ever sought him out particularly. And his personal passion projects seem to be actively not up my alley. But I thought he did good. He did good work here. So, actual 1969. His work seems good. He insists that they put an ad in the Thrifty Nickel, even though that is obviously an outdated thing. He's just sure it's all going to work exactly like it did in 1969, that the candle's just back. And so he places an ad in the Thrifty Nickel under the name Harry Lime. And that's Orson Welles in The Third Man.
Oh, I thought it was some sort of drink. Like, I'll take a Harry Lime on the rocks.
Nope, it's another spy movie, which if you haven't seen The Third Man, it's quite good. So that's an Orson Welles reference. And it actually works. Someone actually calls the ad for the Balthorium G, which Balthorium G is an isotope from a Knight Rider episode.
Knight Rider. Well, I guess we're hitting all the cultural milestones today.
It's just great. So they're going to go meet the candle about this Balthorium G. And I love that the candle really does look like Kleb described him earlier. Like, it looks like Andy Warhol. Like, it's a guy in a black trench coat with a white wig and Wayfarer, like black Wayfarer sunglasses and a red scarf.
And I love that Kevin Sorbo is just like, I think someone like Wendy mentions like sheer elegance in simplicity. And then Kevin Sorbo's like, villains are still saying that, really? Which is a moment I really love, because just like, oh, like this has been a thing that's been happening so long.
Yeah, forever. Yeah, they have a couple of those great like callback moments for Sorbo of being out of time. But he immediately starts making things uncomfortable for the middleman, the modern day middleman, in the car, because they're just crammed into the front seat of the middlemobile. So middleman decides to go for snacks.
What?
And I think he's like asking for like jelly babies and calls him Helen or something.
Yeah, he comes after my favorite. This is my favorite line of the episode, which is he's about to smoke in the car, and middleman like knocks it like, "How are you mad, sir?" And he's like, "What is there something combustible in here? Only my temper when I see a man willingly invite cancer into his body." And I'm just like,
"Yes."
I did some research. I tried to find it. I'm like, okay, I was almost positive that this was a Captain America ad for non-smoking in a Captain America comic, and I couldn't find it, but I'm like, I swear to God, I've heard this before. it just reminds me, I'm like, it's so weird, because while Middleman 69 is from the 60s, it feels like our middleman's like conservative, like he feels like he's from the 50s, and it's just, it's weird because they are their timelines are clashing, but not. And then Wendy is like no one's on the same wavelength in this car. Like they're all from different time periods.
Yeah. And so like, I love his immediate reaction to the willingly invite cancer. Oh, everybody knows that the Surgeon General's a red dupe.
Yeah.
Like,
and this is a point where I felt like the line was not sold right. I was trying to figure out, I'm like, oh wait, is he trying to say that the Surgeon General is a red dupe, as in the Surgeon General is a dupe, or is the Surgeon General is a red and then he's calling middleman dupe?
Yeah, I think he was trying to say like the Surgeon General is a plant by the Russians,
yeah,
or by the commies. Yeah, the middleman bails out of the car to go get snacks, and 69 begins to tell Dubby. Well, Dubby starts to, again, like she's done to everybody, talk about her love problems. And 69 just says in no uncertain terms, like, get out before you fall in love.
I'm just going to lay it down straight. Have all the fun you want with your guy, but cast him aside before you fall in love.
You don't believe in love?
Well, of course I believe in love. That's what we fight for, so the world can love. Unfortunately, we're not the world.
Which you can kind of see bum Dubby out, and that has been a recurring theme in a lot of episodes. I mean, she's watched Lacey not be able to be with Pillow Lips,
mm-hmm,
sexy boss,
like,
man.
This is like a reflection of it's actually fitting because the last episode we talked about was the Tuba conspiracy, which at the very end of that was basically, yes, a middleman kind of learning this lesson, and like it kind of plants the seed for Wendy. Like,
yeah, because it ends on that long shot of Wendy just standing there, letting it sink in that I know they love each other, but they can't do this. And later in the series, Lacey and middleman's love gets brought up again, and weirdly proven. Like, it still doesn't necessarily, you know, I won't tell you how it works out, but mm-hmm, but through they inadvertently find out that Lacey and middleman really do love each other. It's a real love. It still doesn't necessarily change the story. So like I like that there are themes and characters do grow. Like, these things sit with them, and they start to add up in the character, and that to me is just good writing.
Yeah, it does like provide that emotional like nuance to a show that also has hentai tentacle monsters that I really like appreciate. Like, it's like they don't have to do more than like do the references and stuff, and we'd still love the show. But like that extra mile is what really impresses me whenever I watch an episode.
Yeah. While 69 is telling Wendy that she can't love, we watch the candle like do an amazing, like, how is there not blink, 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 like, yeah, how is there not theme music, like tinkly piano or something, as he sneaks past like behind the car. And then you see middleman coming back with snacks and see him and throw the snacks down. And then there's like, I'm a sucker for the trope of like screwball fight that you only see through like a tight window where you just see like a leg come up and an arm and like,
I
love that.
I love, I'm a 90s kid, so I was grown on 80s sitcoms, and this is such an 80s sitcom thing where two characters would be talking about another person, and they'd see them in the background, and then there's some sort of action going on in the background that's related to what they're talking about, or the person just can't get their attention. I don't know what it is.
They're either on fire, or they're choking, or they're, yeah.
I don't know what it is about it, but it's happened a couple other times in this show. It happened with Wendy, when Wendy was on the other end of it, when the trout zombie episode, where she, you know, kills a fish zombie.
Oh, yes, where she's got the fish, yeah, yeah, and she's having to fight the whole fish. And it's honestly, it's how the pilot opens with Wendy sitting there at the, yes, desk talking to her mom, and the scientist behind her like, nah, and like slaps his hand up and it's human, and then slaps his hand up and it's tentacle.
I don't know what it is about that trope, but I absolutely love it. I love a good background fight. It's just great.
So they had that whole fight. They get the candle. It turns out it's not the candle. It's a young kid, and they drag him back to interrogate him back at headquarters, and 69 goes off.
No. He sings or he picks up his own teeth with broken fingers.
Kid just keeps saying, look, the candle's dead. And it's pretty clear the kid's telling the truth.
To me, he was just kindly Mr. McCandle, the cardigan-wearing old guy from the neighborhood. Then this weird thing happened.
He melted your house.
He gave me a letter. He told me not to read it until he was dead. After the funeral, I read it and told me how I could find his melting ray and how to use a thrifty nickel to find Balthorium G.
He wanted you to continue his work.
Nah, he wanted me to donate it to science, see if they could find out how to use it for good. But come on, I mean, a guy leaves you a melting ray, you're not gonna steal some things? I mean, the whole thing is just
simplicity.
So the kid is actually Raviv Ullman, who was Phil from Phil of the Future. I love that the old man just tells him, like, oh yeah, I know, you just put an ad in the thrifty nickel and you get this like weird isotope. Like, how would it never occur to a supervillain? Who else besides the middleman is placing ads in the thrifty nickel selling Balthorium G? Like, is that a thing that's weekly? Like, Like, if you waited till the next week, would there be a legit seller?
Well, we'll see. Like, later in the episode, there's, like, a whole black market for it. So I'm thinking that this universe has some sort of weird... It must have some sort of weird system for all this. Like, it, I'm assuming there's, like, a whole economy for Bithorium-G. Now that I...
Like, yeah, this idea that there's, like, a super science economy somewhere, like, fully functioning in this world.
I think they probably shop at the same place that Dr. Farnsworth gets its, like, antimatter or whatever.
Yes, yeah, or like in The Tick when they all the superheroes in costume eating at the diner or drinking at the same bar. When 1969 just about flips out and starts to pull out, like, basically a large metal stick to just beat this kid with until he talks. And that's when Middleman steps in and is like, that's it, you're done, there can only be one of us, you're retired. And he just retires him.
Yeah, and it was that, like, okay, so this is a great moment of the episode because it gives Middleman a moment. Because, you know, a lot of times Middleman, he'll be played up for jokes and we'll be like, oh man, what a lovable goofball. But then there's always has to be a couple moments where we reminded, like, no, Middleman's a badass. Like, 69 hits him in the face and he gets, like, this look on his face and he catches the next punch, is like, no. First one was free. Next one you're going to have to pay for. And I'm like, oh shit, it's on now. I was ready for a Middleman versus Middleman fight. Like, just, you know, crazy bombs and gadgets. But then Ida comes in for the fucking win. And, you know, like, not even questioning, like, no, I'm with my guy. Like,
well, because Sorbo pulls a gun on him. Like, Sorbo immediately whoops a pistol out. And Ida's like, nope.
There can only be one Middleman, and he's it.
Basically, there can be only one. I like that in a few episodes they've done this where they've hinted at a character flaw, like a jealousy or an inner office power play or something petty in Middleman's psyche. And inevitably, they've never, I mean, it's not that he's not a twinge jealous, but he's already three steps further dealing with it than you think he is. Or it's not that, like, he tells W a couple times, like, no, there's no pissing contest here. And there isn't. He shows it in one move of like, okay, that's it. I was, you know, letting you be here because you're a Middleman, but...
Yeah, I think the most, like, because we see him with Ida, like, he has, you know, they have their own personal in-joke, and then he realized that 69 and Ida had their own thing.
Also.
And it's kind of, yes, like, and you see it in his face, like, oh, I thought that was our thing. It, you know, it's kind of like when your girlfriend has, like, a pet name for you, and you're like, oh, that's cute, but then, like, you realize, like, oh, she called her ex the same thing, and it loses its specialness, and you feel for him in that moment, and it's just sad, and I'm just like, aw. But then you do realize that he did internalize that, and he got over it quickly, because he's like, yeah, he might be around for a while, but I'm in charge. Like, he's got, like, that self-confidence about him that, like, is what makes him, like, a hero, which is, like, why I like him so much.
They have Interrogatory present the Middleman with the gold watch at the, seldom seen retirement ceremony.
It does imply that the Middleman position is normally not vacated by a living person.
I definitely get the feeling that, like, retirement is rare. I think he even says it later, like, any man who retires is breathing rarefied air. The motto off of the crest, which is Pugatos Malos Neos Pugnetes.
Yeah, when I saw the Latin for that, it did remind me of, like, the Nostalgia Critic's motto for whatever reason. And it's like, I fight evil, so you don't have to. And I was just like, I don't know, like, why it made me think of Doug Walker saying it in Latin.
After the retirement ceremony, when he leaves the retirement ceremony, he leaves a civilian. And so suddenly 69 is stripped of his anonymity and he gives his civilian name as Guy Goddard.
It's kind of like when you figure out Wolverine's origin and you find out that his name is actually Jimmy. And you kind of, the character loses a little mystique after that.
It also kind of reminds me of Guy Gardner from the Green Lantern universe, which Guy is definitely that character in the Green Lantern universe of, like, how did the ring pick you? It's the first time in a Green Lantern comic that you realize that the ring just picks willpower and not necessarily, like, ethics.
Because he's always the one that gets shit on by all the other Green Lanterns.
Well, and he's always just, like, crazy and flies off, you know. Man, I always thought Michael Rooker should have played.
Oh, that would have been so good. Oh, my God. Merle as a Green Lantern? I would fucking watch that.
Almost immediately after the retirement ceremony, back at the illegal sublet, Guy's there. And Lacey lets him in. He already knows Lacey's name. He's immediately hitting on her.
Hello, Lacey.
Hi. Strange, but... alluring man with broad shoulders who inexplicably knows my name Can I help you?
Why, yes. You can help by offering the name of the scent gracing that milky white skin of yours.
Turpentine, paper mache, fake blood, and hot glue.
I'll just call it heaven.
Damn it, Lacey. She gets googly eyes, like, every time she falls for this shit, like, every time in this show. Like, she usually comes around on it and she gets saved, but you get this feeling that, like, left to her own devices, like, without friends, Lacey might have made some awful fucking choices by now.
Well, I don't want to spoil for a later episode, but you kind of see where Lacey ends up without Wendy around.
In the parallel universe?
Yeah, and you immediately go, like, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
This is kind of the point where I would have, like, okay, it's not like Kevin Sorbo is, like, he's doing an absolutely fine job. He's actually kind of the best I've ever seen him in this. It's just the point where I'm like, oh, I think we were supposed to like a guy more in the beginning than we were. So, like, we were supposed to kind of be like, oh, this guy's way more fun than our middleman. We were kind of supposed to be charmed with him as well. Like, we're supposed to be Lacey in this scenario, and I was never, like, charmed that way. So when he turns, it's kind of like not a big conflict. We're more like, no, we were with our middleman the whole time. It's not really a big audience turn. And I was just wondering, like, if it was like somebody, like, I believe we were talking about, like, earlier off mic about, like, what if it was like Nathan Fillion or, you know, Bruce Campbell. I think you mentioned the kicker, though, which was James Marsder, with or without the British accent from Buffy.
Yes. Yeah. The guy that was Spike.
And I'm like, oh, that would have nailed it. That would have been perfect.
Yeah. Cause I really wanted to see like a John Hamm, basically. Like I wanted this to be Don Draper now.
Yeah. And that's what he's supposed to be. You know, he's supposed to be the 60s out of time man, but we still kind of like him, you know, like we're still like charmed by him.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like when Dubby goes along with his plan in just a moment, the best I could get was kind of a pity thing.
Yeah.
Because I definitely don't believe that you wouldn't still throw that skeevy fuck out of your apartment.
Yeah, because he comes up with this lame excuse of her trying to get her to come along, and he sells it, and it's just like, you know, if Don Draper were to give the speech, I would have been like, oh, I would totally would have bought it, because he would have been able to sell it. Like, you need someone with a gravitas that, like, oh my god, I can't say no to this guy.
Yeah, it's a carousel. I'm crying. What the fuck?
it's hard to believe Wendy, as savvy as she is, would fall for this for even a second.
So basically, Guy's pitch is this. So he believes that there's 4,000 angstroms of Balthorium G that Lord Jeremiah Purcell has that he's going to get rid of. And one angstrom is enough to level a city or melt a city. So obviously, this can't fall into the wrong hands. So Guy, we'll call him now, This proves that the candle is still alive, and he needs Wendy's help to sneak in to the card game where Lord Jeremiah Purcell is, for some reason, I guess, gambling away the Balthorium. Or no, sorry, they just want to get into the house so that they can steal the Balthorium G.
Yeah, they're gambling a bunch of other stuff, which is really cool.
Yes, so the other stuff they're gambling is insane. But while they're there, he wants to steal the Balthorium G.
Yeah, because like one of them has to like play Shibumi. That's the name of the game, right?
Have you ever played Shibumi? It's a wicked, soulless game. Each player is dealt a full deck of cards. Every card has its own name. There are 589 unique physical and verbal challenges to every hand. And if anyone shows the slightest ignorance of the game's Byzantine rules, they are decapitated by Lord Jeremiah Purcell's manservant, the speechless, thoughtless brute, Govinda.
Wendy has basically 15 minutes to learn two things: how to dress like a woman and how to play Shibumi. Lord Jeremiah Purcell is a reference from Remo Williams. I don't know if you ever saw the Fred Ward movie of the Remo Williams series, but Lord Jeremiah Purcell is Remo Williams' nemesis. But yeah, just crazy reference.
Yeah, and if I could bring up a point about the two things that she has to learn, the Shibumi, but then like how to dress like a real woman. And I don't know if the show has been watching the same show I've been watching, but I know they've been trying to dress down Natalie Morales throughout the show, but she is never not unbelievably physically attractive.
This episode puts her in a couple of costumes that are a little ridiculous.
Again, I was watching with my roommate from the previous episode where I was telling him this. I'm like, yeah, I actually really like her nerdy look. Like, her nerdy look is actually way hotter than almost any other outfit they ever put her in. And then suddenly, like 2 seconds after I say that, she shows up in that leather thing. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah, guy's version of what women dress like.
Yeah. And I was just like, God damn.
So they show up to the card game. Guy's dressed her in this skin tight, like open cut Charlie's Angels looking outfit. And they show up to play Shibumi, which he gives his name as Harry Rule, which is Robert Vaughn's character from The Protectors. Gives her name is Contessa Carolyn De Contini, which is Nyree Dawn Porter, actress's name in The Protectors, which is a British spy show. They sit down at the table with Anatole Gogol, as the monocle. He's a Bond villain. He's the head of the KGB in Spy Who Loved Me. There's Count Manzeppi, the Scot. He's actually Count Carlos Mario Vincenzo Robespierre Manzeppi. He's a villain from Wild Wild West.
Wild Wild West.
Yes. And the icy Vilma Schnipp. And so they sit down to play Shibumi. The buy-in that he uses, guy uses, is the missing 18 minutes of the Nixon tapes. Which, that's awesome.
And it's great because it's like, wait a minute, I thought you were frozen in 69. And he says, time travel. I spent 6 days in the 70s back in 66. And I was just like,
I love it.
Fucking time travel.
And the whole table gives like a soft golf clap when he lays it down. Like, oh, very nice.
Very good. Nice. Oh, yes. Indeed. I love this whole table. What are some of the other things they bet on? They bet on the platform, the plans for the fake moon landing.
Yes, the platform for the soundstage for the lunar landing.
Yeah. I love that that's canon. Like, everything else in this universe is crazy. Like, there's aliens and like and mystical stuff, but the moon landing was still faked. Like, that was a fake event.
Like, honestly, it would not surprise me to find out that we actually went to the moon and that the soundstage and everything was just done like for a whole separate reason.
Just like, no,
like it, if it's even more convoluted, if like both things are true.
No, we ended up, we accidentally met alien life and we're not ready for that. And we didn't shoot any footage on the moon that wasn't with alien life. So we had to like,
we got tired of trying to edit around the aliens.
So we just kind of quick shot something on a Hollywood studio. It was, we didn't think anyone would think of anything of it. I mean, this conspiracy lasted way longer than we thought it would.
So it's our current political climate that's done this, and news cycle climate that's done this. But rewatching this episode, I was struck by how much all this shit now has taken the fun out of the really screwball conspiracies that I used to be able to giggle at.
Yeah, it's hard when you're in a universe that just makes fun of, like, it gets kind of funny to not believe in verifiable scientific facts anymore.
Like, it never occurred to me that I would have to tell people, like, no, 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 you know that there's a point where we have to, like, put this down and, like put our shoes back on and leave Mr. Rogers' world. Like, this is all funny, and then we're going to, you don't really believe it, though, right?
If you were to tell me 5 years ago that I would not only know who Alex Jones is, but see his videos on a regular basis, I would have been, I don't know what I would have done.
I've lived in Austin since 96, and he was on cable access then.
Oh, so he's your neighbor.
I've not personally met Alex Jones, but I've read open letters from people on the bulletin boards at Austin Cable Access talking about, there were two or three open letters of like what a dick he is.
Shocking. Seems like such a,
and then he was in Waking Life and everything. Yeah. So yeah, the last few years of him getting legitimacy has just been insane.
Ugh.
But yeah, it's taken some of the fun out of the, like, being able to laugh at like, the fake moon landing. Like, oh crap. No. I feel I now have to disclaimer that's not true. Yeah. So one of the things that they play for is the lunar landing soundstage plans. And I love that middleman, or guy rather, wins it with 52 of a kind. He has 52 two of spades. And so he takes the plans, says he's going to go to the little boy's room, and Wendy sits in for him.
And then shit just gets weird.
Yeah. For a moment, like, I thought that they were going to do the, like, you know, how is she going to make it through the, does she know the game? She's going to screw up. Nope. She knows it perfectly. She's got it down.
Nope. She doesn't. She never even fucks up. Like, not even when like rabbit gets put on her table, like for no reason, like we get a rabbit on the table.
She's got like three rabbits there. Yeah.
But I don't,
yeah.
I'm like the transition. I'm like, is that supposed to tell me she's doing well? Are rabbits like good? Or like rabbits like her chips? Because the rabbits aren't there later. Did she lose the like, I'm way too invested in the rules of this made up game.
I so want it. Like, yes. It's like Calvin Ball. Like, I want the rules to Shibumi. Because like, with the rabbits in front of her, and she says,
Tuts beat Slims,
cats beat tuts. Double rainbow.
Brother.
Oh.
Like, oh my gosh. She, you know, and she wins that hand. Then they have a mannequin challenge, like two mannequin, three mannequin. And he looks around like it's a bit like four mannequin. And Wendy calls whatever bluff the hell this is.
Yeah.
Of no, no mannequins. No, and you can tell like it's gonna be take off. I think she takes off a choker at two mannequins.
Yeah.
And like she looks down at her underwear and like, no, no mannequins. No,
like,
mannequins.
Is it a
no
combination
way.
Of like the card game bullshit with strip poker? Like how is this game played? Yeah. And it's
and calling her bluff triggers a siege.
Which is basically just building a card house or card fortress.
Like monster card house. Yes, I love it. And then after the siege, somebody gets caught with
a glue stick.
Yes, so Govinda steps in. And that's when, of course, Debbie won't let Govinda just kill somebody.
Nope, no one dies
so
on my watch.
She pulls her gun. Yep. That's when Middleman steps in because, of course, he's just been monitoring her. I think, as you put, like, I'd have been a fool to think he wouldn't come at you with some skeevy plan.
Mm-hmm. I do like that because it's, like, again, like, no, our 69 is never a step ahead of Middleman.
This show moves through tropes, but it rarely seems trapped by them. Like, it just kind of nods at them and then does whatever it's going
to
do next.
I like to think of it as, like, the show, every episode, it sets up a trope machine gun and loads it up and then, like, sits the Middleman in front of it. And then he just practiced Matrix dodging him. Like, just all out of, like, no, you thought we were going to zig, but we ended up zagging. It's great how they just kind of go through. I legitimately don't know what's going to happen next on the show. Like, I love that.
Yeah. So Middleman and Dubby dispatch the card game, and then they go find Guy, who is sitting down by the vault and his hand's melted.
He melted my hand.
The candle? He really is alive?
And the Balthorium G?
Oh, he took it all. 4,000 angstroms. Before I could put the tracer in. Yeah, he said he's gonna melt the moon.
Oh, phooey.
Yeah. Phooey.
I do love Guy in like the metal, like when we find him, he's all kind of like his hand is melted and he's more like just put out more than anything.
The total despondent, like, droopy dog, like, lost.
Damn. Like, he almost goes, aw, shucks.
Like, it's the saddest sack, like, ah, you loser. And so they take him back to the Middle headquarters, and Ida fits him with a mechanical hand. And
not a mechanical hand. It's actually a hook. It's a hook.
Yes.
And I'm like, whoa. We have advanced technology of all this middle stuff where they had the internet.
You've
back
traveled
in
time, for fuck's sake.
They can travel in time, but the most advanced appendage replacement we have is a goddamn hook. And I was almost expecting it later to be turned out like, oh, actually, this is a side detector, because if you can wear this hook, you're actually now an evil character, because only evil characters wear hooks.
And honestly, that wouldn't have surprised me. Of all the effects in the show, the hook is one of the rare times that annoyed me. Characters with prosthetic hands are hard to do. It's always a little too long on their arm, unless you're going to CG it.
The hook is very plasticky looking.
Yeah, this is one of the rare times where I did not like the prop. But all that aside, Guy immediately knows where the candle's going. Because obviously there really is a candle. He just stole 4,000 angstroms of Balthorium G and is going to go to
Snake Island.
What is that, like near Dead Man's Bluff?
Right below the Devil's Throat. I'm just glad to see you've done your homework.
No, what's it really called?
I think Dubby immediately says, like, we can take the middle jet.
Oh, rookie.
No, yeah, when you buy an island to have as your lair, you immediately get anti-aircraft everything and barrier mines and all this stuff. So the only thing that'll get them in is the middle sub, DSV 4600.
Mm-hmm.
And the cancer sub?
Which Middleman's like, yeah, we don't really use that anymore. And you immediately get the reason why, like, no, but only its asbestos layer will like
be the thing that prevents us from being detected. This is asbestos.
So they show up to Snake Island in the cancer sub. Middleman and Guy are both in wetsuits. A guy's wearing the total Sean Connery like shorts with wetsuit top. Wendy, on the other hand, is legitimately in a Bond swimsuit, like the white swimsuit.
Mm-hmm. She even says, like, what's with the Honey Rider Thunderball getup?
Why are you guys in wetsuits and I'm in this Honey Rider Thunderball nightmare?
Honey Rider's from Dr. No.
You make me sick.
Yep, doesn't miss a beat. Honey Rider's Dr. No. I hate you.
She puts on a jacket. Like, she puts on a swim jacket right after, out of nowhere. And I'm like, really, did we just have this here for this joke and from some so gratuitous kind of like fan service?
Yes, that was there. That was there just for the Bond joke of.
But then I'm thinking, I also think
of having her do the Bond girl walking out of the water.
They haven't used the middle sub since the 60s. So all the swimsuits in there, if there are male and female swimsuits, I bet you, that's the only swimsuit.
That's actually in continuity.
The last person to use it would have been Guy, I assume. So that actually makes a lot of sense to me.
They're actually really lucky that Guy didn't. Oops, we didn't bring a swimsuit for you.
Yeah, like
I mean, if he's the last one to have used that sub.
Yes. Just sets up like, oh, I used to take a lot of ladies here.
Yeah. Oh, God. Guy's sad next 10 years would just be awful. Guy on Match.com.
Ugh. Oh, God, no.
So they get to the island, and there's immediately, I love it, there's immediately three doors. Well, they hear a turbine. They hear a Balthorium G, a third stage Balthorium G turbine warm up. Like, Middleman just calls this shit out, because obviously you know that sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that they're going to split up to cover more ground. There are literally three numbered doors, 1, 2, and 3.
Like, they're numbered, like, just in case the person who designed it forgot which hallway went where.
Yep, which I guess that's actually realistic. I mean, you know, if you're going to build a lair that has the multiple halls that everybody always has to split up and explore, how infuriating would it be to live there and be like, God damn it, we should paint a number on these.
Yeah.
So they all take a separate hall. Middleman immediately finds the laser, which the candle has on Snake Island, the world's largest melting ray, and he's going to use it to melt the moon. And so Middleman finds the laser, and we hear it turn on. It's not melting the moon. It's cutting a total Bond villain death trap laser stripe, like watching the saw come towards Connery's nuts or something. Like, it's this total like laser across the room. He tries to shoot at the laser itself to break it at the melting ray. It doesn't work. His gun falls to the floor. We see his gun melt, so we know it's going to happen. The clock is ticking. Like, it really is
a right out of like a Diamonds Are Forever plot line or something like that.
And so we cut back to Dubby and Guy showing back up to the main room, and of course both of their tunnels led nowhere, and Guy just seems to already know, like, nope, we just gotta leave, it's too late for him, Middleman's dead.
Yeah, he's just like, you trust me on it, and just like, it's fine.
It's fine,
he just died, I'll be the new Middleman, it'll be great.
Wendy doesn't straight up not believe him, but she has to see for herself still.
Mm-hmm.
And he just can't let her obviously go see for herself. And as soon as he starts acting a little squirrely, she catches on. He also, I think, immediately pulls a gun on her, or almost immediately pulls a gun on her.
Which she eventually turns around, because he ends up starting to monologue a little bit. And he actually ends up saying, like, my plan is brilliance, or is elegance. And
yeah, sure, elegance.
And I'm like, and he gets that realization on his face, like, oh, shit, no.
Bad guys say this, shit. Yeah, and that's when he's distracted and, like, looks down to the side, and she knocks the gun and takes it. And then they go to try to save the middleman, and I love the reason they can't just turn the melting ray off.
No.
And, like, we got to find the off switch. And I love the, like, no. I defeated the candle by just turning the ray off so many times that he stopped building them with off switches.
I love, like, why even build them with off switches to begin with? But, whatever.
In any show where the villain's going to monologue, and that's what saves the hero, which is most superhero-ish kind of shows, I've always had that moment since I was a kid of, like, if at any point one of these villains just doesn't feel like explaining shit to you,
mm-hmm.
then Captain America's dead. Green Lantern's dead. Like, any of these heroes are dead. If the guy just walked in the room and pulled the trigger and then told the monologue to the corpse,
yeah,
most of your heroes would have died in half their adventures.
Well, it's that arrogance that gets them, Les. It's like, when you're surrounded by goons, you know, they don't get the plan. They don't understand how brilliant it is. But, you know, the hero, Middleman, James Bond, they're smart enough that they'll get it. They'll appreciate the cleverness, the brilliance in simplicity. Like, they'll get it.
Would you say that it's sheer arrogance in its stupidity?
Oh, I'm stealing that.
So Guy manages to turn it off by basically blowing it up, and it kills him to do it. But it's a sacrifice he's going to make, and he even manages to redeem the sheer elegance. Like, no, my plan to granted save you from my plan is sheer elegance in its simplicity. Yeah, so he blows himself up, and we cut to... not a retirement ceremony, but a middleman send off. And they've got Guy's uniform. Ida comes in and sits down a fifth of Fleming's commander, Jamaican rum, and they have like a lovely send off for Guy. And I like that Middleman's like, no, we're gonna go ahead and leave it the official story that that's where the candle and Middleman had their final fight.
But he does say the line, "I am telling the truth. It's the facts I'm changing," and I can't hear lines like that anymore because I'm like, oh, are they facts of an alternative variety? Because I'm not.
I couldn't do it. Yeah, it puts my teeth on edge. Yeah. And because earlier when Guy wasn't wearing the same way earlier when 1969 first defrosts and gets his clothes, he doesn't put on the same Eisenhower jacket.
I don't have to wear Hitler's drinking outfit or smoking jacket. that was a great line.
Hitler's smoking jacket? Yeah.
Crack wise all you want about my Eisenhower jacket, Dubby. But I wear it because it's named after a man who led soldiers through harsh times against the darkest of evils. This jacket says something about me. The man I choose to be.
So what does this uniform say about me other than you're my boss?
If you feel you need to make a change, then make a change. But make it count.
That's what I love about this episode, is that this episode is a microcosm of a middleman's lifespan. We've already seen a middleman, like, trainee come to form. And now in this episode, we see a middleman retire. We see a middleman die. We see the service for that. We see a middleman trainee come into her own and get her own identity. So the only thing we haven't seen, like the only thing left we have not seen, is the middleman, the taking over of the mantle, like a middleman coming in. And that's like the only stage in the life cycle we have not seen yet.
Yeah. And I feel like Dubby getting to change her outfit just a little, because he tells her, you know, make a change if you need to, but make it count. And she kind of changes it to an Annie Hall-ish kind of vest and loose tie that really fits her more, but still looks sharp. And it's kind of that moment of seeing not her taking over the mantle, but her making it her own. Like, it's a little bit the moment at the end of Men in Black with Will Smith and Linda Fiorentino, you know. Like, oh, okay, no, this is you now.
Yeah, the training wheels feel like they're a little bit off, like they're off a little. Like middleman's still, like, holding the bike, like, making sure she's steady, but, like, she's definitely kind of riding on her own now.
Yeah, and I love that these episodes have really meted that out at a pretty steady pace. I mean, you literally see her get paid, you see her get the car, you see her, like, you see her get these little bits of trust more and more. I mean, until, like, literally it culminates in her, in a few episodes later, kind of on her own for a minute, but we'll get to that. And that's about where this episode wraps.
Yeah, with her spending a little more time with her boyfriend.
Yep, it cuts back to Tyler making his famous gazpacho, which he then says is his mutant power, making soup.
I love it. It's adorable.
Yep, perfect opportunity for Wendy to say, "Oh, my mutant power is this awful self-defeating," and she just doesn't. She says, "I don't think I have a mutant power."
Yeah, and it's so cute and adorable, and I love it. And we missed the episode where she calls him right before they go off to the island too, and he's totally like, I you hear this knock at your door, and he like knocks. He's like, oh, you're not there, are you? And he's like, no, I'm sorry. And I guess by the tone of your I'm sorry is that you're not going to be home for a while. Ah, you know what? I totally get it. And it's another moment for him to be like the best boyfriend ever.
Yes. Yeah. And once again, another moment for the show to tee up a sitcom problem and then walk away from it.
Yep. Like, and just drop a Snowdado pun and
yes, and I love that bit. Like, the show has show wide running gags, but then characters have running gags that are their shorthand way to demonstrate bond, like Noser's song lyrics. And for Tyler and Dubby, it's the anything NATO, a NATO made of anything. And I love it.
And it's at that point where I'm like, okay, Wendy, if you're still on this whole mutant ability of I know how my relationship ends, and if you're going to let this ruin it, I'm a mostly straight man, and he's the, like, I'll take him, okay? I mean, he makes me feel like wanted and desired, and you should, you know, be appreciative, goddammit.
And I love the way that she phrases it at the end that,
you know what? The more I get to know you, the less I want to know how it ends.
Yeah.
Which is just a, that's not a, honestly, I kind of finished the episode thinking that's how I feel about this show. The longer I watch it, the less I want to know how any of these stories wrap up. I just want to see these people's daily lives roll on forever. Like there's no one big fringe plot I want done. Like
I just want to see them hang out more. Like I want to see them hang. And it's, he delivers a great line too of like, you know what, maybe, if we say goodbye tomorrow, we can do that. Or maybe we'll wake up 70 years from now and rub Vic's vapor rub all over each other. Like, tempting. But yeah, either way, I'm in this. I'm in this for the long haul. And I'd be a shitty boyfriend if I'd let like this little thing upset a huge balance. Like,
this is also the episode where Dubby found out who Tyler Ford is.
Yes. This is the episode where
Wendy comes back to her apartment and Tyler has been let in and is making an anchovy pizza because he remember with a side of ranch because he remembers it's her favorite from her telling him the story of her botched quinceañera. That is some deep boyfriend points, folks.
Yeah.
You were doing it right when you're doing it like that's pretty deep.
And also, are her taste buds dead? Like, that is gross.
Oh Christ, that sounds so awful. Like that sounds so terrible to me. I hate ranch dressing. I don't want Yeah. But he makes it for her, and that's love, folks. Though granted, he does it in someone else's kitchen, I think is key. At that point, she's still looking pretty nervous about her mutant power, and
she comes up like with this, like, I need to talk to you about something, and she has kind of like a downer look on her face, and he goes like, you found out. And we're kind of like, what's he worried about? Because he's apparently gone through this a bunch of times. Like, you found about me being in a band. And it turns out he was,
I was the lead guitarist in Casanova Charlie.
Awesome. Wait, shouldn't you be richer and less groomed and on Valtrex? Should I?
And he wrote a song for his, how does he put it? My monogamous, herpy-free girlfriend. Like, I love how he just prefaces his exes with like, oh yeah, no, and we were monogamous and herpes-free. Named obviously Monica, and he wrote a song about her called Dreams of Monica. And I think W is like, you mean that number one song? She rattles off a couple of lines from it.
I only have dreams of Monica. She's the night I long for. She's the light I see.
Yeah, I'm working on a second verse. It goes something like, Monica left me for that D-bag bass player, and I walked away from the band before they hit it big.
It's catchy.
And so he should be a millionaire, but he's not. And he basically just nails it. Like, people date him and then they find out who he is. And for a little while, it's novel that you're that guy who quit a band and took the moral high road. But now you're just a broke loser who quit a band.
Yeah. And it's like it gives his character something like, because the rest of it, the time, he's just the perfect dude. Like, he's perfect for her. And he's like the audience, like, oh, he's kind of hot and he's very attentive and emotionally open. He's end of all the same nerd things she is. And it gives him this like backstory of like, yeah, a lot of stuff in my life didn't work out. And I made a lot of mistakes and I kind of like had a lot of rough stuff actually did happen. And I'm not perfect, but I kind of let that all roll off my back. And I'm just kind of I don't let it, you know, much bother me now, which makes him kind of like a really three-dimensional character to me in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, this show does that great. I mean, there's a lot of plot in every episode. There's a crazy amount of plot. And it's all really fast-paced and busy and full of references. And so the moments that you have for character development matter. You got to make those minutes matter. And the screen time and what they do, like how far Lacey comes in just a few also funny but also deep little scenes across the season, you know, across the series. I even get something out of Noser, who is completely a man of mystery.
And it's never like they totally 180 on a character. They really just make a small little change. Like with Noser later, we'll find out his special talent. Like it's one quick change to the thing, but it count. Like what Middleman says later in this episode, make a change, but make it count. And it's totally the myth. Like it's totally the ethos of this entire show is just the making the little things matter. God, I love this show.
Well, thanks again.
Yeah, that was great.
Fire and brimstone. We do not smoke in the Middlemobile.
Why not? Is there something combustible in here?
Only my temper when I see a man willingly invite cancer into his body.
Cancer? Everyone knows the Surgeon General is a red dupe.
The
Good Die Young is an independently run podcast produced by Les Weiler and hosted as part of the Permanent Record Network. We can be found on the web at thegooddieyoungtv.com. Les can be found doing weekly television commentary at www.thetvdudes.com. Thanks for listening.